From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People living in the Soviet Union had to endure severe limits on their physical freedom. But the journalist Masha Gessen says the worst part was that their government robbed them of their ability to make sense of their lives. And being able to know where you fit in the world, she says, that's a function of freedom. Soviet leaders took away psychologists and philosophers and writers, so Russians lost the tools, and she says even the language to know themselves. In her new book, Masha Gessen tries to capture what that means and how it explains the rise of Vladimir Putin, whom she says has built a brutal mafia state on the ruins of the Soviet Empire. That's what her book is about, how it is totalitarianism has reclaimed Russia. Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Masha Gessen was born in Moscow. She left with her family when she was young, though went back to work as a journalist. In 2012, she wrote a book exploring what she called the unlikely rise of Vladimir Putin, and it didn't go over so well. She had to leave the country in a hurry. This was a time when Putin was feeling like his power was waning, so he had begun this crackdown. A crackdown, by the way, that worked. His popularity took off, he consolidated power, and Gessen has been wondering why that happened. What she realized is that the old mechanisms of the Soviet Union were still around, like state terror and the domination of a single party. And Putin had somehow managed to use those mechanisms to stay in power. Today in the program, Masha Gessen is joining us to talk about her new book. It's called The Future is History: How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. In it, she tells the story with seven characters, including four younger Russians who have come of age in the era of Putin. Masha Gessen is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her work has appeared in The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, Vanity Fair, among others. She joined us from a studio in New York City. I guess where I want to begin is your personal experience. Born in Russia, in Moscow, you and your parents left when you were something like 14 years old, and then, of course, you come here and develop a career as a journalist, and as a correspondent, you went back in the early 90s, and I guess that's where I wanted to begin. Worked as a Russian journalist, as an American journalist there, and you write about how the first time you went back, I think it was 1991. Could we start there? Because you write about how you felt at home when you get there. It's a pretty heady time.
It was an extraordinary time. It was the first time I went back was in March 1991. So it was still the Soviet Union. And as long as it was still the Soviet Union, kind of everybody assumed that the Soviet Union was going to last forever. Right. And at the same time, it felt like everything was in flux and everything was possible. And when I was there, Mikhail Gorbachev, then the president of the Soviet Union, actually banned demonstrations. And there were tanks in the streets of Moscow. And something that is impossible to imagine in today's Russia happened, which is that people went out anyway, and they ignored the tanks. They walked around the tanks. They swarmed the tanks. At one point, it looked like the tanks were sort of drowned out by the crowd. And Gorbachev did not crack down.
Yeah.
And there was this giant demonstration in support of Yeltsin. And that was when I first saw, Galina Starovoitova, who was then a member of the Supreme Soviet of People's Deputies. She was a young academic who had become a politician. I saw her speak. She was absolutely galvanizing. She would later become my friend, and then she was murdered in 1998.
What did that heady sense of change and kind of optimism tell you about, I guess, the character of the people who had been traumatized for so long, which, and we'll dig into this as we go, of course, but what did that tell you about the potential for the trauma? I mean, you must have felt differently about it then, that it seemed like it could just fade away.
At the time, I think I and like most Moscow intellectuals that I know and most Western observers, not necessarily other people in Russia, right? But those two groups were thinking very much in sync. And I think we thought that all you had to do was just topple the Soviet regime and Russian people would be just like people in the West. You know, Russia has long identified, or parts of Russia have long identified with European culture, which is to say Western culture,
yeah.
Which is to say sort of liberal democratic culture in the 20th century. And so so we thought this was just going to happen for us. All you had to do was kind of flip a switch. And later, much, much later, I came to look at that time very differently and to think that, to see really a sinister aspect to it, which is that it was a population of people who developed incredible skills for sort of knowing which way the wind was blowing because that was the best way to survive. And they were just as sincere about being a part of that demonstration for democracy in the streets of Moscow in March 91 as they had been, you know, demonstrating on International Workers' Day on May 1st in years prior, because that was where the power was, that was the way the wind was blowing. Which is not to say that these were cynical people or bad people. These were just people who were fragmented in a particular way that that maximized their chances of survival in a totalitarian society.
Yeah. You write about this, almost this kind of species, Homo Sovieticus. And it's an idea conjured by Yuri Levada. Let's talk a little bit about that. He wants to invent a public opinion survey and wants to get at this question of what kind of, I guess, what kind of regime is the Soviet Union and who the people are who follow this regime. Take us through this part, if you would.
So he was trying to do something that other theoreticians of totalitarianism hadn't tried to do and hadn't had the resources for doing. He actually didn't have a question about what kind of regime the Soviet Union was. It was a totalitarian regime.
Of course.
What he wanted to understand was what ensured the continued survival of that regime.
Yeah.
And his hypothesis was that it was a particular, you said species, he would be careful not to use that kind of language, I think. He called it a cultural institution.
Yeah.
Right? So a cultural institution is something more than a behavior, but less than a full human being. It was a combination of behaviors and social associations, I think, that created Homo Sovieticus. And his idea was that Homo Sovieticus was the kind of person who had developed in response to the totalitarian threat, very much the same way that if he were a psychologist and not a sociologist, he would talk about somebody who had lived a traumatic experience for a long, long time, and so developed ways of surviving in that situation,
yeah.
Right? This is an entire society that he's talking about, and so he invented this term Homo Sovieticus, and he hypothesized certain traits in Homo Sovieticus, and then he conducted a survey, and his hypothesis was that Homo Sovieticus had developed in response to terror. And that terror in the Soviet Union had actually ceased around the mid-1950s, after Stalin died. And so by this time, by the time Levada was able to actually undertake his survey, the late 1980s, more than a generation had passed. And so he thought that Homo Sovieticus must be dying out,
right?
Because people didn't actually need those skills and behaviors to survive anymore. Because they were faced with a kind of post-totalitarian society where the threat was present but not as lethal, and it was kind of applied randomly, and things just weren't as frightening. And so that society couldn't be controlled by that milder threat once Homo Sovieticus died out. And so his idea was that if Homo Sovieticus was generationally bound, then by about the end of the 1980s, Homo sovieticus would die out, and then the Soviet Union would collapse because Soviet institutions rested on Homo sovieticus.
Right.
Well, he conducted the survey,
yeah,
and he concluded that his hypothesis was borne out because indeed he found this person that he had hypothesized, this Homo sovieticus, the set of traits that was typical of a large proportion of the population. But his results seemed to indicate that indeed it was generationally bound, and so the Soviet Union should collapse. And sure enough, right on schedule in 1991, mm-hmm, the Soviet Union collapsed.
But then it came back.
Well, but then what happened was that in 1994, they went back to do the survey again. And they were shocked to get kind of weird results. Their results would indicate that in the 5 years since they had done the survey, and in the 3 years since the end of the Soviet Union, the proportion of Homo sovieticus in the population had not diminished. We sort of flew in the face of all of their hypotheses, both you know, the idea that it was generationally bound, and also that, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union would speed up the disappearance of the Homo sovieticus. So that hadn't happened, and this group of sociologists was so disturbed by this that they actually suggested that a Soviet revanche was possible. And they were really laughed off, you know, the newspaper pages, to the extent that, you know, it's been interesting to do this research because I used Levada data throughout my career as a journalist in Russia, and I interviewed Lev Gutkov, one of the protagonists of the book, the sociologist who now heads the Levada Center. Mm-hmm. I interviewed him many, many times over the years, more times than I could count before we even started talking for the book. And I don't remember ever hearing this from him about the 94 survey or the 99 survey, which was even more disturbing when they actually concluded that Homo sovieticus was not only thriving but reproducing. I don't remember hearing that. And of course, I must have heard it. I just couldn't absorb it.
You couldn't imagine that it was the case that people would somehow sort of go back to this fearful, isolated, authority-loving personality contained in
that. It's at the time, especially in 94, the idea that the Soviet Union was going to be sort of recreated in some fashion seemed so absurd that it couldn't be right. It couldn't even be heard.
Yeah. A good part of the book is, of course, what happened, how Russia reverted to this older type. But you also wanted to talk about what did not happen, why freedom and democracy wasn't embraced in the way people thought right then. You explain in a prologue to the book that you had to decide how to tell a story like this, you know, and I wanted to have you explain, because I wanted people to get a sense of what this book is like. It's you focus on various characters and their experiences. That's how you've chosen to tell. And one of the things you say early in the book is that a lot of people look at Russia like that Indian fable where you have six blind men trying to explain an elephant by just touching separate parts. You wanted to use the characters to tell what a more, I guess, a holistic view of what that country is about.
Right. So I wanted to write what somebody tries to write every couple of years, which is the Russia book to end all Russia books.
Right.
I figured it was my turn. There are a couple of things that I was trying to do. One was I was trying to break out of the convention of writing nonfiction books. Right. And these are the kinds of books that sort of are written in the middle distance. And what I mean by that will be explained by what I actually did, which is that I try to never use the middle distance. I basically am either inside the heads of my characters, mm-hmm, and there are seven characters in the book, or I try to really take the bird's eye view, really zoom out and talk about the academic research and other research that produces theories that perhaps explain what I'm talking about. And I did try to spend at least half the time sort of inside these people's heads. And the people are four people who were born in the mid-1980s. And the reason I wanted to focus on them was because I've been obsessed for many years, actually, with the predicament of people who grew up in the 1990s. I thought that there was something very special to that experience of, on the one hand, observing your parents who are both scared and confused and exhilarated,
right,
sometimes at the same time and sometimes in turn. But at the same time, and this is something that again, I've been obsessed with for a long time, at the same time, you could turn on the television and see absolute moral certainty in the Soviet propaganda films that were still on TV.
Right.
And so that was sort of my starting point for wanting to talk to dig deeply into people from that generation. And also, of course, that's the generation of people who were in their early 30s when I started writing the book. They're in their mid-30s now. They're sort of the current generation. But they were also people who were at the forefront of the protests in Russia in 2011, 2012.
Right.
And for many of them, their lives changed drastically as a result of the crackdown that followed. So I wanted my characters to be those people, the people whose lives changed drastically as a result of the crackdown. And I also wanted them to represent sort of different socioeconomic strata and so have had different experiences and different relationships to power. So one is the daughter of a politician, the other one, another is the grandson of a key intellectual in Perestroika. And one of them had to be gay because I needed to be able to write about the anti-gay campaign from the point of view of somebody who experienced it firsthand. So those are sort of the four drivers of the story. And then three other drivers are intellectuals,
right,
a sociologist, a psychoanalyst, and a philosopher from older generations.
Right.
And the reason that I needed them in the book was that I believe that for either people or societies to be able to move through and pass trauma, they have to have intellectual tools.
Right.
If you don't have a way to think about what's happened to you, again, either as a person or a society, then you can't do anything with it. And what happened in the Soviet Union was that the social sciences were destroyed.
Right.
They were destroyed in a very sort of goal-directed, profound way. For decades, you couldn't get books on psychology or sociology. Sociology was virtually a banned science.
Right.
The philosopher in the book, in the mid-1980s, gets hold of a Heidegger book on microfilm. And he doesn't have a microfilm machine, so he rigs up a children's projector and reads it on his own desktop backwards.
Right. Ruining his eyes, right?
Ruining his eyes, yeah, in the process.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that story is sort of so instructive and so tragic at the same time, because, of course, like 2 years later, you could read all the Heidegger you could swallow in
right.
Russian.
Right.
But who knew in the mid-1980s that that would happen?
Well, the story of Alexander Dugin, that's the person who destroyed his eye. He becomes a fascinating, I don't want to say antagonist, but he becomes a very, in some way, I sort of see him as a sort of Steve Bannon character, and maybe I'm.
Oh, I think you're
yeah,
exactly right.
Yeah.
And of course, this is one of the weird experiences of writing this book, is that when I was researching Dugin, the last thing that I could imagine was that when the book came out, things that I didn't actually spend a lot of time on in the book, which is his intellectual influences, because it seemed so obscure,
yeah,
right? But of course, these are the intellectual influences of Steve Bannon, detailed very nicely in a new book by Jesse Green, I believe. And where he goes into quite a bit of detail, but it's like reading about Dugin.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get to him in just a moment, because I really want to dig into whether or not there is or was an quote unquote ideology attached to the Soviet regime. There's an argument that comes up, an essay written in 1969 that says it. Hold on, before we get there, because I think I want to ask, I want to stay a little bit on this idea of how the Soviets basically destroyed the social sciences and what that, what kind of trauma that invoked. Because you write, as you were just saying, if a modern country has no sociologists or psychologists or philosophers, you know, what can it know about itself? And basically, this idea of not being able to go inside yourself and do some self-analysis seems to be an important reason for why they couldn't assess their own sort of internal dialogue or make make an assessment about what was happening to themselves.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, again, you need language. And in the area that I'm trying to tackle in the book, comparisons between societies and people are actually pretty useful.
Right.
And so imagine that you've lived through something horrible, or even that your life is just changing in ways that are profoundly disorienting and quite frightening. But you have no language of feeling and making sense of feeling. No language of psychology.
Right.
No way to frame for yourself what you're feeling. It's like a part of you never developed, never matured. It's very difficult to live through changes. All you can do when you don't have the tools basically for coping and for making sense is to try to stay in place, to try to hold on to behaviors and patterns that are known.
Yeah.
Because that at least gives you some control.
Masha Gessen, journalist, writer, activist. Her new book is called The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Masha Gessen about how it is totalitarianism has reclaimed Russia. Gessen argues in a new book that Vladimir Putin has built a mafia state designed to plunder the country and hold on to power, but that he's built it on the ruins of the old Soviet order. Her book is called The Future is History. She joined us from a studio in New York City. Let's talk about Marina Arutyunyan. Is that how it's pronounced?
Arutyunyan, yeah.
Arutyunyan, a psychoanalyst. She's a terrific character in the book, and you write about her. You know, her own maternal grandmother had been a high communist official. Her grandfather died in a gulag. It'd be a fascinating backstory. And there's one of the stories of one of her patients, which is kind of a metaphor in some ways you've talked about for the book. If it's this young girl who kept doing all of these unspeakably cruel things. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because that gets us to the idea of kind of subconscious trauma and the effect that has on the way people behave.
Yeah, so Marina Arutyunyan, the psychoanalyst, I think she is probably my favorite character in the book. And in the 90s, she is working, 90s and aughts, she's working with people, some of whom are sort of trying to figure out family patterns, and one patient who comes to her is a woman who's having trouble with her daughter, and the daughter keeps misbehaving in really inexplicable ways, like she sets the curtains on fire, or she locks her grandmother out on the balcony in the cold. And very quickly, they figure out that, of course, the girl, who's like 10 or 11 years old, I think, is expressing aggression against the grandmother that the mother herself can't allow herself to feel, which is devastating for the mother, obviously. But then they dig further and they realize that the grandmother, who is this sort of household tyrant, used to work as a guard in the gulag. Right. And that the little girl, subconsciously or unconsciously, recreated a torture practice from the gulag, the locking somebody out in the cold without warm clothing is something the guards in the gulag used to do. And that, to me, is a metaphor for the entire society, which I think keeps acting out torture practices, or not quite torture practices, that date back to the days of terror without knowing what it's doing and why it's subjecting sort of itself and, you know, it's one citizen and subjecting fellow citizens to such incredible abuse.
It seems like there's, in order for Russian society to be able to properly confront totalitarianism, it's going to have to deal with this large question of trauma, don't you think?
I do think that that it would have to deal with a large question of trauma. I don't know if it's possible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not like Russia is the only country that's ever been through trauma. Obviously, I mean, we as humanity in the 20th century raised horribleness to unprecedented scale.
Yeah.
But I'm hard-pressed to think of a country that had terror for so long and where terror didn't other the victims in any way, right? Yeah. So, for example, in Nazi Germany, Germans were exterminated, right? But they were seen as Jews, as other. And the majority of Jews were not German, in fact, right, who were exterminated. And so Nazi Germany, going through denazification, had the crutch of having committed crimes against an other. It had had another crutch, which was that people were either bystanders, victims, or perpetrators,
right,
which I think was made possible partly because the violence was against, perpetrated by one group against another, but also because the terror existed for half a generation. Right? It didn't last for several generations. So in Russia, everybody was both a victim and a perpetrator, and there were no bystanders.
Yeah.
That's an actual totalitarian society doesn't allow people to be bystanders. Everyone has to be in it. So we're basically asking Russians to say, we did this to ourselves.
Right.
No one occupied us and made us do this. We did this to ourselves. And in many families, including Arutyunyan, the psychoanalyst, the victim and the perpetrator were in the same family and, to an extent, also the same person.
Wow. You say at first Putin's regime was authoritarian. But then after 2012, 2011, right around that time, it becomes totalitarian. Because it became, and I think this is how you've put it, profoundly political. So Putin does not want people sitting home being ambivalent to social situations. He wants them active and vocal and patriotic. It is a highly mobilized country. I wanted you to say something about that, because this seems an important understanding.
Right. So there was a theorist named Juan Linz, who was a double exile. As a child, he had left Nazi Germany, and then he also left Franco's Spain. He was also a political theorist. And so based on those experiences, in part, he advanced the a theory of distinctions between authoritarian and totalitarian regimes. And probably the most important distinction is between mobilized and non-mobilized societies. So in a totalitarian society, everything is political,
right,
and everyone is mobilized. In an authoritarian society, nothing is political, right? Nothing involves common action. Nothing involves the public sphere. Basically, an authoritarian ruler wants people to stay home and tend to their private business, mm-hmm, while one person or a group of people rule the country and often plunder it. In a totalitarian society, the dynamic is the opposite. It's still one person or a group of people, mm-hmm, but they want people out in the public square. There is no private space, and they want everybody to be cheering for, you know, the next victory, or screaming out their support for their leader. Now, with Putin, I don't think he set out to build a totalitarian regime.
Yeah.
That's not his ambition. His ambition is to hold on to power and to plunder the country and to get just very, very wealthy. So he was perfectly happy being an authoritarian. At a certain point, authoritarianism stopped working.
Right. For him.
For him.
Right.
He could not hold on to power as an authoritarian. In response to the protests in 2011, 2012, he could either start compromising, which would have brought about the end of his regime, mm-hmm. or he could crack down. And I think when he was cracking down, again, he didn't have a totalitarian model in mind. His ambition is to build a mafia state, basically.
Right.
But he was building his mafia state on the ruins of a totalitarian society.
Yeah.
And so the society reverted to its habits, and the people in it reverted to survival skills that they knew from generations of totalitarianism.
So did Alexander Dugin and others give Putin a kind of ideology, this return, you know, this sense, exploit the nostalgia for an imaginary past, or exploit this concern for LGBTQ people, or this loss of quote-unquote, you know, values? Is this the kind of ideology that Putin turns to keep himself in power now?
So, you know, ideology is a tricky thing.
Yeah.
I think we because we learn about ideology usually from history books, we always imagine that it's coherent and complicated and sort of, you know, tells a whole story. If you read contemporary observers, even of the most potent ideologies of the 20th century, you see something quite different. Eric Fromm, the social psychologist and psychoanalyst who wrote, I think, one of the greatest books, actually, about Hitler's Germany, Escape from Freedom, writes about... He actually writes that Hitler has no ideology, mm-hmm. that he is an opportunist who just keeps throwing out ideas and seeing what sticks, creating a kind of cacophony.
Right.
Hannah Arendt, writing a dozen years after Eric Fromm, wrote that one of the reasons that the world, by which she means the Western world, was so slow to understand the full sort of horror and threat of both Hitler's and Stalin's regimes was because their ideas seemed so preposterous. Mm-hmm. How would you believe that millions of people could be exterminated because they were the wrong quote-unquote race or the wrong quote-unquote class? You couldn't believe it. It was preposterous until it happened, right?
Right.
And so, but in hindsight, we imbue those preposterous ideas with the force of ideology. I think that Putin is a lot like what Fromm described, right? An opportunist who picks up ideas because they're lying around. Or in his case, they're not particularly lying around. There's Alexander Dugin, who has made it his project to feed ideas to the Kremlin.
Right.
He's a philosopher who follows the traditionalists with a capital T, who has this idea of a Eurasian civilization, has a lot of ideas.
Right.
One of his ideas is that ideas matter, that ideas need to bolster power, that power needs to rely on ideas, that the Kremlin ignores the need for ideas at its own peril. And so when Putin was cracking down, he helped himself quite liberally to what Dugin offered, right? For a while, it was popular among Russologists and Kremlinologists to think of Dugin as a sort of Putin whisperer. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's quite like that,
yeah.
right? But I think that Dugin made his ideas available and Putin used them. They're accessible and they're catchy and they do tap into something that I think is close to Putin's heart and close to a lot of Russians' hearts, which is a longing to be in an imaginary past.
Right.
This sense that there was something that worked at some point that is not quite remembered, and that can be summed up in the word tradition. And so when Putin queerbaits protesters and talks about traditional values, it resonates. And then he uses Dugin's language when Dugin says that Russia is the center of the traditional value civilization, and it can stand up to the West, which is trying to cram its ideas of universal human rights down people's throats.
So I'm trying to make the connection. I'm wondering if you do to a Donald Trump tweet. When Donald Trump sends a tweet related to the NFL players not kneeling for the national anthem, is he doing the same kind of thing, exploiting his Dugin, you could say, as Steve Bannon, some of those ideas, returning to this nostalgia for an imaginary past? Or am I overstating that? Oh, no. Okay.
No. I don't think you're overstating it at all. I think that they are weirdly similar in that way. And yes, their sort of semi-whisperers are also weirdly similar in that way. Right-wing populists generally traffic in nostalgia and imaginary pasts.
Masha Gessen, her book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Masha Gessen. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. I have to raise the substance of your article that you wrote about John Kelly and that press briefing that you've there's an article that you wrote for The New Yorker, an essay. And you say that Kelly's press briefing last week, where he defended President Trump's phone call to that military widow, Maisha Johnson, is what a coup in this country, I want to make sure I underline that, is what a coup in this country could potentially look like. And you include four arguments for this. And I wanted you to maybe take me through some of these. The first, you say, is this argument that Kelly makes, that those who criticize don't know what they're talking about because they haven't served in the military. Explain that, if you would.
Right. So, yeah, I listened to Kelly's speech and it sent shivers down my spine because so much of it was familiar. We've looked at the White House and the three generals in the White House with this weird kind of relief, right, as they walked in one after the other. Conventional wisdom has been that they're the grown-ups who can hold Trump accountable because he has such respect for generals. But the question is, when you have generals taking civilian posts and being tasked with keeping an elected leader in check, well, that could be viewed as a military coup.
Right.
Whether or not it was designed as one. So as I listened to Kelly's speech, I thought that his speech consisted of four parts,
right,
each of which advanced an argument. So first, he basically said he went on this long explanation of what happens when an American soldier, is killed in battle or killed abroad.
Right.
And when I first saw reports of his speech before I read the transcript, it was clear that journalists who were writing about the speech were really puzzled as to why he went into such incredible detail, right? Because he described, the body is put on ice,
right,
and then it's flown, and then it's put on ice again, and it's just like endless detail. So, and about how the soldier or the officer who is dispatched to notify the family waits outside the house until the lights come on. I mean, it's kind of fascinating
to
have that view, but But I think the message of that long introduction was to say, look, you people, you journalists, civilian journalists, have been writing about this, but you don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because the only way you would know that what you're talking about is if you had served in the military. Now, you know, this is an argument that journalists hear with some regularity, I say, as someone who's been a journalist for 35 years. Yeah. But it always gives me pause when journalists hear the argument from military people, mm-hmm. right? Because it should, journalism is definitely a civilian profession. And criticizing journalists for not having served in the military is, I think, problematic. And when it's done by the chief of staff in the White House, it's really scary. Mm-hmm. Right?
I actually wanted to list a few more of these arguments that you make.
Yeah.
The second argument, or that Kelly made, that you pointed out, the second argument Kelly made, you say, is that the president did exactly the right thing because he did exactly what his general told him to do. Third argument, communication between the president and a military widow is, I think the word that Kelly used was sacred, and basically nobody's business but theirs. And then the last argument you point out in the article is that this is this one. Citizens are ranked based on their proximity to dying for their country.
Right. So this to me was the most disturbing part of the speech, because it came up early on and sort of in the middle and then at the end, right? It was the theme. Mm-hmm. He started out by saying that the soldiers who die for their country join the best 1%, I looked at the numbers. I was trying to figure out what the best 1% is, because my initial assumption is the best 1%. He must mean people in the armed services are the 1%, but actually, the number of people serving at any given time is much, much lower than 1% of the population. And the total number of veterans in the population is actually much, much higher. Mm-hmm. It's more than 7%. But he was referring to people who have died, soldiers who have been killed, because later, and that's about, that number is actually weirdly equal to 1% of Americans currently living. Because in the middle of his speech, he says that he was so shocked by the criticism that President Trump received, that he had to go walk among the best men in the country. And he knew where to find them. He found them in the Arlington Cemetery. And then finally, at the end of his speech, he said that he would take a couple of questions, but he would only take questions from people who knew Gold Star families. Right? And again, he's talking to journalists.
Right.
Journalists are meant to represent, you know, they're sent there by the public to find out what's happening and tell the public what's happening, right? That's our job. And earlier he had said, you know, you people don't generally even know anybody who has been killed in battle or anybody who knows anybody who's been killed in battle, right? So he said that out from the outset he said, and most Americans don't even know a Gold Star family.
Yeah.
From the outset, he said that most Americans don't know anybody who's related to somebody who's been killed as an American soldier. And then he disqualified journalists who don't know anybody who's been killed from asking questions. Basically saying the people who represent a majority of the population have no right to question me, the White House chief of staff.
I want to ask you about, I want to come back to this idea of quote-unquote ideology, which I don't want to oversimplify. Again, it's a complicated way of thinking about it. There was Francis Fukuyama wrote an interesting review of your book for the New York Times. He's the economist and political theorist. And the one thing that he mentioned that he thought might be missing from your theory here is that idea of ideology, that You can't really label Russia, as he put it, as a totalitarian in the absence of a strong mobilizing ideology. You've talked about how strong, whatever you want to call it, it is that undergirds Putin's, you know, control of power. So I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that, because Fukuyama seems to be saying that, here's how he puts it. He says, I somehow doubt that fear of pedophilia, or he's referring to, you know, this idea of traditional values, will be a sufficiently grand cause to rouse a deeply traumatized people and make them great again. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to this question that seems whether or not this is so profound as a motivator for the Russian people that they'll look beyond economic stagnation and keep Putin in power.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a long book. So I suspect from reading that review that maybe Francis Fukuyama didn't quite make it to chapter 14, which is entirely devoted to parsing out definitions of totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I have a long discussion, and I know I'm making the book sound really sort of nerdy. I promise it's not. I promise it's character driven. But there's this chapter where actually Lev Gutkov, the sociologist, is trying to nut out what he's observing, right? And so he ultimately comes up with his own definition of totalitarianism. And he also, I think, comes up with a beautiful term, which is recurrent totalitarianism. And he says recurrent totalitarianism is a little bit like a recurrent flu or recurrent infection. It may not be as lethal as the first time around, but the symptoms are unmistakable. But basically, his hypothesis is that when a totalitarian society is reconstituting itself, not when a totalitarian regime is first established, right? We sort of have established in political theory that when a totalitarian regime first comes into being, it uses a strong ideology to justify the terror that it imposes. And the pillars of a totalitarian regime that's building itself is terror and ideology. But Gutkov is saying, look, if it's already had the generations of terror, if it already had the ideology that was initially used to fuel the terror, then maybe when it's sort of being reverse engineered, it goes in the opposite direction. It begins to remember to sort of create the institutions of horizontal enforcement first, because they were initially created by the terror. And then it gradually sort of backs into terror, and then from there it backs into ideology.
Let me ask you this finally. Are you sensing, I think there was a survey recently, and these kinds of surveys come up all of the time, that put Putin's approval rating at somewhere approaching 86-87%, which you've pointed out is an indicator of the fact that this is a totalitarian regime, of course. But I guess it raises the question also of how enduring then is Putin's popularity, and how enduring then is the strategy that he's come up with to manipulate the trauma and the values of people? I mean, how enduring do you think that is these days?
So actually, it's his popularity rating, which is important, weirdly, now, because people have been talking a bit about how Trump's approval rating seems not particularly high. Putin's job approval ratings aren't actually sterling either. But his popularity rating is sky high. It's about 86%, and it's been in that region since the invasion of Ukraine, since sort of real mobilization kicked in. And I had this wonderful conversation with Lev Gutkov, the sociologist, when he printed out a graph, or he'd actually charted two graphs on one piece of paper. One was Putin's popularity rating, which had skyrocketed around the invasion of Ukraine. So it was like a vertical line up from 50-something to 86%, and then it stayed steady. And then it was the consumer confidence consumer confidence index, which is a combination of survey results, sort of looking at how people feel basically about the economy and about their own future. And that plummeted right around the same time. The Russian economy basically was tanking, and it has stayed down at the bottom. And Gudkov was looking at this graph, and he was saying, well, this is impossible. You know, these lines have to meet. Because people have to come to see how, you know, their sense of their own subjective well-being has to influence how they feel about the president or not, right? And if it's not happening, then that means that the habits of a totalitarian society have really reconstituted themselves. And people no longer see a connection between how they feel subjectively and how they feel when they identify with the great state, which is really sort of the hallmark of Soviet doublethink.
Yeah.
To answer your question, this is a very long-winded answer, but to answer your question about how enduring it is, well, we have no idea. We saw in the 1980s how fragile something that seemed to be forever can be. There's a book with a not great book with a great title, which is Everything was Forever Until It Wasn't, which is a book about the end of the Soviet Union. So that's very much what the end of the Soviet Union was like. If Putin makes a mistake or if Putin dies, I think it's extremely likely that the system will crumble very, very fast. But it's a closed system, so we'll know that it's happened when it's already happened.
That's Masha Gessen. Her new book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. She joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.